Fab Sesmat Show, broadcasting live from the Skyview Network Studios.
You're not kidding. We're broadcasting live from the Skyview Network Studios, and a hail and hearty Wednesday to you. I'm Jeff Munn from the Arizona Diamondbacks. I'm in for Brad today and tomorrow. And the reason that I'm in for Brad is that Brad is up in Portland, and we're going to hear from him a little bit later on in the show. The Arizona Wildcats will be in the NCAA tournament, the men's tournament. I need to signify that, and if you know me, you know why. But they are in the men's tournament in Portland at the Moda Center. They'll take on Texas Southern tomorrow. And Brad is in Portland. He'll be getting off the plane and talking to us, discussing what is going on in Portland and previewing tomorrow's first-round NCAA first round. I guess they call it the second round now. Second-round NCAA tournament game between Arizona and Texas Southern. But we're here today and tomorrow, and you want to tell yourself there are quiet times on the sports calendar. There aren't, and that's great. It keeps shows like this hopping and gives you a lot of reason to come to sports360az.com, azcentral.com to catch our show every day, and we appreciate you doing that. We have other things to talk about today besides the tournament. We're going to talk to one of my buddies over at the D-backs, Tom Candiotti, D-backs radio color analyst. You're starting to see the picture come into a little bit clearer focus in regards to the roster decisions with the Diamondbacks, as we're now kind of basically at the midway point of spring training. So I would we'll talk with Tom about his impressions, because he's seen them a number of times, obviously, and get his thoughts about what he thinks, who the favorites are, who some of them are not for roster spots, particularly in the pitching rotation. That'll be coming up at a little bit later on. And Brad, as I said, will join us by telephone from Portland, or Skype, actually. I beg your pardon. Skype. This is a much more technologically advanced operation than to just do stuff always on the phone. And Brad will join us from Portland, as he will be there to cover the U of A's games in the NCAA tournament beginning tomorrow at the Moda Center in Portland, which, by the way, I've never been inside the Moda Center, but I've driven by it a number of times on my travels with the ASU women. And, boy, that's a magnificent facility from the outside, and it seats, what, 20,000 for basketball, and they'll probably fill it up with a lot of I suspect a lot of U of A fans will make their way up there. But in the meantime, let's get to what's going on in the world of sports on this Wednesday morning, March the 18th. By the way, Eric Sorensen, the producer of our program, I am colorblind, and I can't always tell shades. Is this green?
No.
It's gray, right?
Yeah, it's gray.
Okay. I just literally, just before we came on, it just struck me, I might be wearing a green shirt the day after St. Patrick's Day.
That sounds like something you would do.
Yeah, I don't. And again, this is a funny story, but it's true. I am colorblind in the sense that I cannot tell certain shades apart. And I was doing an NCAA tournament game between Arizona State and Temple in College Park, Maryland, in 2008. And I admitted on the air I did not know what color jerseys Temple was wearing. They kind of looked cherry red. And I just admitted on the air, and I've always been honest with my audience, there are some colors I can't make out. I got barbecued on a message board about, how can Munn not tell what color uniforms there were? And I can't.
You should have just Googled, like, what color does Temple wear? And Google would have told you.
And now you tell me.
I know.
Yeah.
I wasn't there with you in 2008, though, but I am here today.
Thank you, and I appreciate that. And let's get right into the top stories of the day, brought to you by the Honda Resort and Casino, located in the beautiful White Mountains just outside of Pine Top in eastern Arizona. Head up now. Enjoy ski season before it ends. They might get, I guess there's precipitation in the forecast up there today. Make sure you stay at the Honda Resort and Casino. We have basketball, we have baseball, but there's a lot of talk about football because this Adrian Peterson story continues to have, as we call it in the trade, legs. I think it's fairly obvious at this point that Adrian Peterson is not going to return to the Minnesota Vikings. And I'll get into the periphery type of issues with Adrian Peterson in a minute. But obviously, there's a lot of speculation about Peterson maybe signing with the Arizona Cardinals. Now, yesterday on the Brad Sesmat show, Larry Fitzgerald Sr., who in addition to being Larry Fitzgerald Jr.'s dad, is a well-respected writer up in the Twin Cities and really has his finger on the pulse of the sporting community up in the Twin Cities of Minneapolis, St. Paul, joined Brad on the show yesterday and said verbatim, or pretty much point blank, maybe not verbatim, but he did say Adrian Peterson wants out.
He doesn't want to be with the Vikings anymore. He feels like he's been, he just feels like he had a problem with the way they dealt with him during this last year. Mm-hmm. And he felt like he had more loyalty coming to him from them. And so that's his feeling. And because of that, he soured on staying with Minnesota.
Now, there are some real, and I'm going to talk the football aspect first. It's a very natural fit to assume that Adrian Peterson would be interested in Arizona and vice versa. Even with Andre Ellington in the fold, the Cardinals could always use a game-changing running back. It would make things infinitely easier on Carson Palmer on the passing game. Bruce Arians, an offensive guy, and he knows the value that a good running back would add to his offense.
And you have to realize, Jeff, that only the Oakland Raiders were worse in the entire NFL in rushing the football than Arizona last year. Hard to believe, but the stats don't lie.
That I am a diehard Raider fan, and I don't know why you keep bringing that stuff
up
on this show.
Sorry about that, but again.
But you're right.
Yeah,
not
good.
They signed Trent Richardson yesterday.
They did.
Which, you know, I'll just step back for a second. On the surface, I don't think that's that bad a move. I know that it was a huge flameout in Indianapolis. But I'm thinking to myself, okay, he probably came fairly cheap, market-wise. And
like $2.5 million a year.
Nowhere to go but up with that guy.
You would think. But is there a reason why two teams have pretty much given up on this guy and he's, in his third or fourth year in the NFL?
Yeah, I understand that. I don't think it's a bad gamble at the price. Excuse me. And I would just say that I just don't think it would be that bad an investment. The other thing is, as I watched the Raiders last year, in all seriousness, they've got a quarterback. Derek Carr can play the position. Is he, you know, among the best? Is he a Russell Wilson? No, but he can win games with people around him. So what I thought the Raiders really needed going into the offseason were a running game and some offensive linemen. Now, they've got draft picks, and they're also, you know, if you want to get into that discussion of Marcus Mariota, I don't know why I've gotten onto Raider talk, they could deal that pick. If Philadelphia thinks they can move up to a position where they can get Marcus Mariota, if they want Mariota, they could deal with Oakland and get multiple picks in return and get the offensive lineman to protect Derek Carr. You add Trent Richardson to that, and you're on your way. Why are we talking about this?
I'm not talking to you. You're just basically talking about
it. I'm talking to myself. But one other thing. Okay, Larry Fitzgerald Sr., as I said, very dialed into the sporting community in Minneapolis-St. Paul. So the question posed by Brad, is Arizona a viable option at this point?
I've seen a list that has the Cardinals, I think, number two or number three on that list. Dallas, obviously, because he was born in Texas and he lives in Houston. So I would think the Cardinals are certainly right there in the hunt to have a chance, if they choose, to go after Adrian Peterson. I know Adrian and my son have a good relationship.
Mm-hmm.
They go to the state fair every summer.
Well, there, and that's the other part of this equation. Larry Fitzgerald just re-upped to stay with the Cardinals, and he has a very close relationship with Adrian Peterson. Now, let me take 30 seconds and just get it out on the record about the off-the-field issues involving Adrian Peterson. Clearly, I don't advocate or support anything regarding his actions with his son. And this is a sports show, and I'm not going to get into discussing the societal pluses or minuses. But I'm going to simply keep this on a football vein. If you just judge it on football, it's a no-brainer. Get Peterson in here. I'm not saying sweep the other things under the rug. But I think it's important for the fan base to understand that for the Cardinals will do their due diligence and examine this thoroughly from all aspects. And if they sign Adrian Peterson, they're going to do it after having thoroughly thought out what are the implications within the community to signing Adrian Peterson and what can we do to address those concerns within the community. And I'll just leave it at that. There are going to be concerns. There should be concerns. There should be issues raised. There should be questions asked. But the Cardinals, one thing I will say about Michael Bidwell is that he will do his due diligence. You're talking about a guy who has experience in the legal community and has dealt with these issues as a federal prosecutor. He's going to take his time to research this completely before a final decision is made. Arizona, as we said, in Portland or on their way to Portland to prepare for the NCAA tournament. They're probably there. Press conferences are today, and they will play Texas Southern tomorrow. Sean Miller saying, and it's a no-brainer, but it's you have to remind yourself of this once in a while, they are very much in winner-go-home mode right now.
You know, I don't have to tell you guys this. The first round for everybody is difficult, more so now than ever before. And you have to be ready. This isn't a best-of-three format. It's who's the best in that 40 minutes. And there's a lot of factors that weigh into it. Early foul trouble, you know, sometimes guys knowing that, in fact, it's finally here, aren't themselves. Teams aren't themselves.
And you know what's interesting? He sounds just like Herb Sendek. It's the voice inflection is just
the same.
He does a little bit. By the way,
he doesn't coach like Herb Sendek, though.
Why did you have to go there?
Sorry.
By the way, our coverage of the Arizona Wildcats trek through March Madness is brought to you by Quarles and Brady LLP. Sports 360 AZ's exclusive partner for the Wildcats trek through March Madness. They have offices across the country, including Phoenix, Scottsdale, and Tucson. For more, visit www.quarles.com. On the subject of Herb Sendek, that's an awful way to go into it, Eric. But we will mention very briefly that ASU does have an opening round game tonight in the NIT, tonight East Coast time, against UConn. I will talk more about this and Herb in another segment a little bit later on in the show. But I think it is a winnable game for Arizona State based on two things. I think they'll come out with a chip on their shoulder after the way they played against USC last Wednesday in Las Vegas. And you never know about UConn or teams on the bubble that miss the NCAA tournament and what their mindset is going into the NIT. It fluctuates. Sometimes they say, we're going to prove to the country we deserve to be in. Other times they kind of just say, you know what? We're just not emotionally ready for this after the disappointment of not making the tournament. Be interesting to see tonight. We'll come back. We'll talk some more about what's going on basketball-wise, all kinds of things in sports. It's the Brad Sesmatch Show. It's Wednesday. Jeff Munn from the Arizona Diamondbacks in for Brad. I'll be here today and tomorrow. And you'll be back with us right after you check out this commercial break.
For in-depth, unique coverage from the high schools to the pros, follow us on Twitter at Sports360AZ.
On a Wednesday, the Brad Sesmatch Show. Jeff is trying to remember to look directly into the camera. Is this the right camera I'm on, boys? Because I'm trying not to look at the monitor. That's just a very vain thing for a guy like me at my age. By the way, I have lost weight. Have you noticed? 35 pounds since.
Congrats.
Thank you.
You look
I'm
good.
Not allowed to say the national weight loss chain, but Marie Osmond's their spokesman.
Oh, gotcha. Okay, I'll play
and Marie
along.
Osmond's coming to town in a couple of weeks. And I don't think I may not be working that night. Just saying. I don't, you know. All right, I'm not even going down that road. We've got other things to talk about. And it is time. They allow me to do this whenever I fill in on this show, and we don't have a real cutesy opening for it. But it is time for Uncle Jeff's Story Time, which is a feature that we pop up every once in a while on this program. Eric Sorensen will be allowed to contribute wherever he so chooses.
I always do, even
so
you if
might
you
as well
don't
go,
ask
yeah,
to.
Go ahead and so, get him up on camera. He might as well. I mean, he's gonna get his 2 cents in.
There I am up in the corner. See, I'm not.
Is he up in the? There he is up in the corner.
Hi.
All right. I know that Brad and you had a discussion a little bit on the air the last couple of days about Herb Sendek. So I'm going to get my 2 cents in here. I was going to do it in a podcast, and I am going to do a new podcast after the show today. But let me do it here. A lot of people coming off the loss Wednesday to USC at the Pac-12 tournament immediately jumped onto social media and wanted Herb Sendek run out of town. Now, the thing I find interesting about this is nobody was really saying anything about Herb one way or the other. Then one loss and boom, everybody wants him run out on a rail. Okay, this brings up a question that has been raised in different ways, in different forums for the last 33 years. This camera, thank you. Live broadcasting. And it is simply this. What is the realistic expectation for Arizona State men's basketball? There are a lot of schools around the country that are really strong at one of the revenue sports and not strong at the other. In fact, there are a lot of schools within the Pac-12 And the one that comes immediately to mind is USC. USC has never, ever, ever been a really dominant power in college basketball. They were a very successful program in the early 70s when Bob Boyd was the coach there. But there was a team across town that got all the attention, and rightly so, in UCLA. So a lot of times, USC would have these fabulous seasons nobody would know because they couldn't beat UCLA. Now, USC is just miserable. Yes, I know, it's embarrassing to lose to them in the Pac-12 tournament. I get it. But the bottom line is, and Andy Enfield, who was hired there from Florida Gulf Coast a couple years ago, next year he needs to really show some progress at that program, or people are going to start talking about his future where he's employed. All right, let me rewind a little bit here and take you back to 1982. Arizona State had come off a sub-500 season. Byron Scott sat out the year because, and I don't remember the particular reasons, but it was speculated that there was some tension between two of the assistant coaches on Ned Wolk's staff. And Scott sat out the year. Fat Lever played a senior, had a fabulous year, but there's just nothing around him, and they struggled to, I think, a 13-win season. And at the end of the season, Ned Wolk was reassigned by, and it wasn't really the athletic director at the time, Dick Tamburo, who was heavily involved in that decision. It was a provost on campus. And it was just at the time that the NCAA tournament was really turning into the mega event that it is today. And this provost looked at it and said, we need to get to a point where we're a Final Four type program. And to do that, he said, we need to hire a coach with Final Four experience. Bob Weinhauer was hired from Penn because he got Penn into the Final Four in 1979. They are literally the forgotten team in the magic Larry Bird Final Four in Salt Lake City. But he did get his team to a Final Four, and he got the Arizona State job based on that accomplishment. It didn't go well. The decision to dismiss or reassign Ned Wolk, I think, is something that Arizona State men's basketball, it took them a long time to recover. And in a lot of ways, they really haven't recovered fully from it yet. Ned Wolk won over 400 games as the head coach at Arizona State, had a number of really outstanding teams. The last really great teams under Ned had five NBA caliber players in the starting lineup. He had a backcourt at one point of Fat Lever and Byron Scott. He had a front court that included Alton Lister, Kurt Nymphius, Johnny Nash, Sam Williams. Immediately somebody's going to say, well, why didn't that team make a Final Four? Yeah, there were some really head-scratching, tough-to-take losses in the NCAA tournament. In particular, the last game that ASU played in the NCAA tournament under Ned Wolk was a loss to Kansas State. I think it was Kansas State. It might have been Kansas. But ASU was a top-five team going into that tournament, and they lost in their opening round game. At the time, I think the tournament was 48 teams, so some teams got a first-round bye. So, in effect, they were playing not a 15 or 16 seed in their opening game. And it was an embarrassing loss. It was tough to explain, and there were people who wanted to run Ned Wolk out of town. There had been for years. But Ned won more than he lost, essentially ran a very clean program. You never saw his kids in any kind of trouble most of the time. And he ran the kind of program that for that era was very respected around the country in college basketball. And Ned himself individually was very well respected. All right. Essentially, in doing what they did in 82, it speaks to the real bottom line question that has perplexed people around Arizona State for years. What is the realistic expectation for men's basketball at this school? I have always made the analogy, and Eric and I discussed this before we started the show today, that there's always been a real easy-to-link analogy between Arizona State basketball and Arizona football. Arizona's a basketball school. There's no question about it. And I could tell the story again about Lute Olson coming out here when Ned Wolk was moved on and there was an opening, and he came out for a weekend. He was the head coach at Iowa, took a look around, decided there wasn't enough support for basketball at Arizona State, got back on the plane, coached another year in Iowa City, and a year later he's the head coach at the U of A. Arizona has always put a priority on men's basketball, and the results are obvious. They've had a nationally viable and relevant program for most of the time since Lute Olson arrived in 1983. Arizona State has struggled to maintain consistent success, and they've tried. It's gone from Bob Weinhauer to Steve Patterson to Bill Frieder to Don Newman for a year to Rob Evans to Herb Sendek. And you haven't had the sustained success that some people in the ASU community want to have. There are people within the ASU community that still think that Arizona State should be a consistent Final Four contender. The problem is there just isn't enough support, whether it's financial in terms of boosters, whether it's in terms of ticket sales, whether it's in terms of competing. You know, there's just not enough to back that level of a program. And I think most everybody will reluctantly agree to that. So given that, if we're all to agree that there isn't the amount of financial backing within the community for Arizona State basketball as exists in Tucson for their program, then you get to a question of, are you satisfied with what kind of coach you have? And again, I'm not doing this to defend Herb Sendek. You come to your own opinion, and I'm not going to try to sway you one way or the other. But let's just deal with a little few facts. Herb Sendek's won more than he lost. Herb Sendek, if you include the NIT, and we have to in this discussion because of the realistic expectations for Arizona State men's basketball, they have been in postseason more seasons than not. They are playing in the NIT. It is a postseason tournament. And, you know, you can say what you want about the NIT, but it is a postseason tournament. He's going to be on national television tonight. You know, you have to acknowledge that this is a postseason event, and they're in. They won more than they lost this year. Has there been a sniff of NCAA trouble with Herb Sendek's program? No. And please keep in mind, friends, with all due respect to those who were involved at the time, that Arizona State had some really serious problems with not just NCAA investigations, but just legal matters in the mid-90s. And, you know, those things aren't forgotten quickly. So you have a clean program. Rob Evans restored the integrity and the dignity of this program after some really rough incidents away from the court in the mid-90s. Herb Sendek has kept this program clean. His players graduate. Yeah, he doesn't get the blue chippers. He doesn't get the one-and-dones. He's had a couple of guys, and Jahi Carson and James Harden, who have been guys to build a program around. And admittedly, there haven't been guys that have always consistently followed that up. But go back to my original question. What's the realistic, and I underline that word and put it in bold type, realistic expectation for this program? My friends, and I'm as Sun Devil as they get, this is not at a level where they should be expected to be in the Final Four discussion every year. Could they be? Sure. If the money started pouring in to build a new arena, to upgrade facilities, and they, by the way, they do have a state-of-the-art practice facility, and that's pretty much where most of the donation dollars have gone to, and that is an upgrade. And it, part of me says recruits are a little bit, you know, they're just as concerned with practice facilities as they are with playing facilities. But until the time comes that money just comes in the form of a Brinks truck, this is what you've got. And it's hard to say this to people who expect nothing but success constantly, but you ought to be pretty pleased with what you have, at least in the sense that clean program, kids graduate, coach wins more than he loses. He does. Go look it up. I'm not selling this to you based on a hope or a dream or a whim. The man wins more games than he loses. And at the end of the day, what are you looking for? Look down at Arizona football. We make that analogy. Rich Rodriguez had a fabulous year. They went to a New Year's Day, what's the term we use now? It's not BCS.
It's a Big Six
bowl. And played in a Big Six bowl, went down to the wire with Boise State, didn't work out. But they went. They were there. They were on ESPN playing in a Big Six bowl. I don't know. He has a freshman quarterback that I think is pretty good. But I don't know if he's going to be able to sustain Arizona football at that level long term. Why? Because there's not enough money down there to build a Florida State. Well, Florida's not a good example right now. But a Florida State, Ohio State level, Alabama type football program. Either Rich Rodriguez will have another couple of 10-win seasons and bolt. And come on, as long as somebody's out there waving a big check, Rich Rodriguez is always going to be a candidate to leave. Or he's going to not be able to sustain 10-win seasons. He'll have 7-win, 8-win seasons. He'll go to the New Mexico Bowl. He'll go to the Holiday Bowl. And everybody all right with it. What are people saying about Arizona State football? Todd Graham, consecutive 10-win seasons. That's great. When are we playing in a Big Six Bowl? When are we playing in a Rose Bowl? And it's realistic to expect Arizona State football to contend for those type of bowl games. Why? Because Arizona State is a football school. Why did Arizona State baseball change coaches after making the postseason? A lot of people were very upset over an early exit in a regional. This is Arizona State baseball. We don't do that. 5 national championships, more major leaguers than you have a calculator to count. The expectations are a certain level. And again, I'm not trying to convince you that you should get off Herb Sendex back. If you're upset, you're upset, and there's nothing I can say that's going to change your mind. But I just want you to keep in mind two things. The realistic question, what's the realistic expectation for this program? And number two, how much do you value the fact that you have a head coach who wins more than he loses, graduates his players, and runs a clean program? Just things to think about. We'll talk baseball with Tom Candiotti, a guy who's forgotten more baseball than I'll ever remember. Coming up next on the Brad Sesmatt Show. Brad Sesmatt Show on a Wednesday. Jeff Munn from the Arizona Diamondbacks, and here comes one of those awkward moments that I go through every once in a while when I do this show, and I do this show every so often. Tom Candiotti, D-backs radio broadcaster, joins us, and I haven't had a conversation with Tom Candiotti since the end of the season, so I may have to reintroduce myself. Candy, I'm Jeff Munn. I'm one of the broadcasters for the club. I know I haven't been around spring training much, but you will see me a lot starting in a couple of weeks.
Great. Are you a rookie this year? Do I know you?
Listen, I texted you from Cal State Fullerton. I sent you a picture of the baseball game I was at, and you never responded.
Yeah, I must have been busy. Sorry about that.
So how have you been?
Everything's been great. You know, life as usual.
Yeah.
You know, off season you turn into a dad and do all you can and then the season kind of gears up and you go into that baseball mode. So it's kind of the pattern that we have.
Yeah, no, I know how that works. I've been spending a lot of time in parking lots at Corona del Sol High School picking up my daughter, so I know how that works. Let me, in all seriousness, let's talk a little baseball, and we'll start first by talking about pitching. We're starting to see now that Andrew Chafin's been told he's going to fight for a bullpen spot. Vidal Nuno's been told that. And part of it is just they're getting to a point where they're running out of innings to run a lot of guys out there to compete for starting spots. But I still think, and you've seen a lot of these guys pitch, that everybody's got to be pretty pleased that it's not a matter of we can't pick guys because they stink. You know, we can't pick one out. They've still got a lot of competition because a lot of guys have pitched really well.
Well, and that's, you know, you have a plan. The front office has a plan, and you start formulating all that, as you go through the off season, as you're acquiring people, evaluating, you know, what you have in the minor leagues and what the guys did last year. And you know, you kind of have your rotation that you'd like to see kind of pan out. But, you know, there's surprises that happen all the time. There's injuries that happen also. And so spring training, you know, kind of becomes a big question mark. You know, you're kind of leaning towards certain guys, but also you're keeping an open mind and open eyes. And, you know, if you get impressed by somebody, whether it's Chip Hale or Tony La Russa, Dave Stewart, that's what they want to see. And so, you know, having said that, you know, you've already named, you know, Josh Coleminter as your opening day starter, and Josh has been throwing outstanding baseball. You know, some of the guys that, you know, other guys have been throwing well, too. You know, I saw Oliver Perez throw the other day. I thought he looked outstanding at Scottsdale. I thought he threw the ball well. I have seen Coleminter throw. Little by little, you see guys in just little spurts. But a lot of times, you know, you have to take that with a grain of salt money, because early in the season, early in spring, you know, guys, pitchers are usually ahead of the hitters. You know, but then, you know, the breaking balls are going to start getting better as you get towards, you know, the middle to late this spring. You know, hitters are going to get a little quicker as they, you know, as their hands kind of get in shape, their arms and stuff like that. So, you know, spring training is fun to look at stats and all that stuff, but that's not necessarily what guys, you know, in the front office are overwhelmingly looking at. You know, they like to see good stats, but they want to see how the ball is coming out of certain guys' hands and you know, who they're pitching against. Are they pitching in the eighth and ninth when there's guys in there you don't really know who they are? You know, so there's a lot of things that go into it, but I think overall, right now, I think things are shaping up the way they were kind of planning on it.
Tom Candiotti, D-backs radio analyst, joining the Brad Sesmatch Show. Jeff Munn for Brad. We've watched Josh Colemanner over the years. Is he the type of pitcher that can be a top-of-the-rotation guy in the sense of what a team needs out of a number one pitcher in terms of the ability to get deep into games?
You know, there's so many people that get caught up, oh, he's the number one. Oh, nope, he's the number two and all that stuff. And, you know, what does that really, really, really mean? You know, it's, to me, it's having a guy going out and competing against. If you're going up against a Madison Bumgarner, Josh Colemanner has the ability to beat Bumgarner, you know, very easily. You know, you saw the way he pitched yesterday. He's very capable of doing that. Now, is he going to, you know, do that on an everyday, have an outing like that on an everyday basis? You know, you're not sure. You got to kind of rely back on the track record. You know, we saw Madison Bumgarner as one of the best pitchers in the history of baseball in the playoffs last year, in the World Series especially, and, you know, that's what sticks in our mind right now. But, you know, I think just having guys to go out there, take the ball, not worry about being a number one, a number two, a number three, and all that stuff that people like to label them with, but taking the ball and going out there and giving your team a chance to win, giving them the opportunity to, if you score, you know, two or three runs, even four runs, our team has a chance to win. And I think that's how I look at guys. So whether Josh Colemanner is your opening day starter, whether he's your third starter, whether he's your fifth starter, if he's matching up against Madison Bumgarner or Adam Wainwright, you know, I think, you know, he can put up a performance that's capable of beating those guys.
Tom Candiotti from the D-backs radio network joining us on the Brad Sesmatch Show. All right, let's go over to one of the other areas that's getting a lot of attention. That's at third base. Tomas played Monday in the outfield, and that got a lot of people wondering, well, is he really still in the third base mix? Jake Lamb has had a nice spring. Brandon Drury's hitting a hide off the ball and can play at third. That one, to me, sounds like something where the D-backs are still very much in evaluation mode over at third base.
Well, I think, you know, in a perfect world, I think they would like to see Tomas, and I think they just want him, you know, just to be able to be average or just decent over there, make the plays, just the routine plays, and count on his bat after that. He hasn't really swung the bat that well this spring, but take that with a grain of salt, too. You know, he's hitting, you know, just a touch above 200. You know, I had a prolonged discussion with Tony La Russa the other day and about Tomas, and Tony had some really good things to say that he really liked about him, especially his hitting, and he likened him a lot to Pujols. Early in the spring, he said Albert Pujols likes to hit the ball the other way, up the middle. He really tries to let the ball travel and then, you know, being able to hit the ball line drives the other way. And he goes, you know, that's what I see out of Tomas. And he goes, as you start getting towards the end of spring, you know, Albert would pull the ball a little bit and kind of get that going. But he wanted to establish, you know, that right center field dominance, you know, early in spring. So hopefully that's what Tomas is doing. And, you know, there's a lot on that kid's plate. You know, there's a, you know, not only the money that he signed for, you know, coming from Cuba, you know, getting acclimated to new teammates, you know, a different country, you know, there's so many things that it just takes a little while to adapt and get comfortable. And once major league players get comfortable in a situation, that's when you start seeing their performance, you know, really kind of take the next step. So, you know, all that is a work in progress right now, Tomas. I know that they may play him in the outfield. I think, you know, it presents a lot of different options on the team. If he plays outfield and maybe, you know, it opens the door for Drew, who, like you said, is having a great spring. I think he's hitting about 450 or 435, something like that I saw before. you know, and he's got some power going. You know, Jake Lamb, who swings the bat in Portland, you know, Jake Lamb is a left-handed hitter, power hitter that you want to have in this right-handed, you know, predominant lineup. So there's options there, you know, and what does it mean for Peralta and Inciarte if Tomas goes to the outfield now? You know, those both those guys have been having really, you know, strong springs, and we saw the way they played last year. They're excellent, and they deserve to be in the lineup. So, you know, there's a lot of other things. You know, other guys that have opened my eyes. You know, Nick Ahmed really has opened my eyes. It, you know, I didn't think he was much of a hitter a little bit I saw last year. I think he swung the bat better. His defense is off the charts. Outstanding. A.J. Pollock, I just knock on wood, he stays healthy this year because he has really swung the bat well every time that I've seen him. So, I mean, there's, and I think for the Diamondbacks in general, and you've seen all those games last year, Money, that, you know, they just got decimated with injuries. And if you can get those guys healthy and in the lineup for, you know, most of the whole year, then well, what a completely different team they're going to have.
I would agree with you. And one other thing about Tomas, and you pitched in your career in winter ball down in the Dominican. I've said alone to people, don't be surprised if they send Tomas to the minors very briefly, because most players that come from Cuba, and I think Puig was in double A ball before he got up to the big leagues, and there's a lot of the Soler has been in the Cubs system forever. From your experience, when hitters come from the Dominican or Cuba, there's an adjustment because of the type of pitches, not so much pitching, but pitches they see, isn't there?
Well, I think there's, like I was just kind of hitting on a little bit, there's so many adjustments. You know, the caliber of Major League Baseball is much better than, you know, the caliber that the Cuba's playing. They have some wonderful players down there, but, you know, they're not major leagues and they're not seeing major league pitchers day in and day out. So there are adjustments to be made. There's no question about that. You know, and being able and having to play every single day, you know, it's a different grind than, you know, playing, you know, tournament ball and you know, just not, it's a grueling season that Major League Baseball players, you know, go through. And so, you know, that's one of the things, you know, everyone says he fits in great. He's very energetic. He's a, you know, looks like a great teammate, does all that stuff. So, you know, but there's other things of you know, having to travel all the time and having to order and having, you know, getting acclimated to, you know, to America. And so there's, it takes a little progress and you have to have a little patience with them. And, you know, you nailed it on the head with Puig. Puig had a tremendous spring with the Dodgers. They sent him down to the minor leagues. And when they brought him up, you know, he torched MLB. So he, you know, that is probably a possibility. I'm not sure, you know, I'm in no position to ever try to say what you know, the front office is going to do, because we're not privy to any of that stuff. But, you know, but it has happened. You've cited a good example there with Puig.
Tom Candiotti, the D-backs radio analyst, with us for another minute or so on the Brad Sesmatch Show. And I've got about a minute. Tom, in addition to his playing career, also has experience working in front offices in baseball. So I've had people say to me, you know, what do they do? You know, Peralta deserves to be in there. Trumbo is an everyday guy in right field. And it brings up the subject of trades near the end of spring. Now, we don't see a lot of major deals at the end of spring training. But is it possible, given your experiences with this, that Dave Stewart starts taking phone calls toward the end of spring training about some big-name guys on this roster that he just may not have room for?
Well, you know, I think Stu takes phone calls all the time. I think there's just always conversations that are going on. You know, I think one of the big things that a general manager has to do, and in my experience, you know, working with general managers was, you know, you have to look at the option situation at the very end of spring training. You know, there's, you know, that seems like every team always has a little problem with which guys have options left, which guys don't, which guys are going to have to make the club or else, you know, those things really come into play. But, you know, I think, you know, ultimately it's the general manager's job is to, you know, put the best product he can out there on the field. And, you know, if a trade that's going to help the Diamondbacks in some way presents itself, then, you know, they're going to look at that hard. But, you know, I don't think you just trade guys to trade them so you just make room. You still have to do stuff that's going to help your team and your organization. So, you know, it's going to be interesting. And I think that's why this spring has been really enjoyable to watch, and it's going to get more so because of all these battles that are going on.
I agree with you. And there's a couple more weeks left for the club to sift through all this. Well, I'm sorry we hadn't talked since the end of September. We did exchange a few texts, but I promise I'll get out and see you soon before opening day. I promise. And tell everybody I said hi. I've got a little more basketball to do, but I will see you soon, and I appreciate you coming on with me today.
Well, you hang in there, and, you know, congratulations on all your winnings in at your penny slots. You know, I always get the updates from you, so it sounds like you're having a good off season that way.
It hasn't always been good. You just only hear the good news. So thanks, Candy. I'll see you soon.
All right. We'll see you, buddy.
All righty. Tom Candiotti, the radio analyst for the D-backs radio network. And it is interesting. There's going to be a lot of interesting decisions. And I do think that there is a possibility lurking out there. I mean, what do they do? I mean, Peralta deserves to be on the Major League roster, deserves to be an everyday guy in the outfield. What do you do with Cody Ross? How do you handle that contract? And Ross has hit well in the spring. These are fun decisions, but they're decisions nonetheless. And we thank Candy for being with us. We're back with more of the Brad Sesmatch Show momentarily. This is a bonus day on the Brad Sesmatch Show. Well, it's not a bonus because Brad's not here, but he's going to join us later from Portland. But it's a bonus day for you because you get a second Uncle Jeff story time. I'm going to throw a little curveball at Eric Sorensen here because I'm going to talk about something that I had told him that we would never discuss on the air. But I think it's a good time to bring it up. Because there is a serious message to it. Do I want to do that first, or do I want to get into the fun stuff first, Eric? You're the savant.
It's your show.
You're
thinking out loud again.
That's true.
I'm paying you to talk.
Can I do it? Okay, let me just do this serious, because I don't want to belabor this point.
Okay.
But I don't know if this camera can do up close, but I'm going to hold up my left arm. Can you zoom in on that, or do you have that capability? You don't?
We're trying.
Okay,
I see you zooming.
Okay,
do you see
a little mark here?
I do.
On my left arm?
Yep.
I'm going to break some news. You know where I'm going with this, and I haven't talked about it a lot in public. Please don't be alarmed. I had a little health scare about a month ago, melanoma. It was caught very early. Everything's fine. I'm going to see my dermatologist a lot more often than I used to. I hadn't seen a dermatologist before. I had a little thing here on my arm, a little boo-boo at the end of the season, and I thought, well, it looks like a scab. So I, what this term they use, expressed it. And it bled a little, but it never went away. Never changed in size, never changed in color, any of that stuff. So sometime right before Christmas, I saw it again, and the reason I didn't see it every day is because this is where I used to wear my wristwatch. So it would hide. And that prompted me to call the dermatologist, and shortly after the new year, he removed the boo-boo, because I don't know what else they call it. And a couple days later, he called back and said, it's melanoma, it's skin cancer. But they caught it very early, and there was never really a moment where I was in a really life-threatening situation. But we did have to do surgery, outpatient surgery, to dig deeper and make sure we got rid of it. I have a family history with cancer. I lost both my parents to cancer. My oldest brother, who would be 68 today, died of colon cancer. So because of that, they wanted to take out a few lymph nodes, and they did it right around here. They took a piece of my skin right near my elbow to skin graft over the where the melanoma existed. So it was a little nerve-wracking, but they did run a test on the lymph nodes. It came back negative. Everything's fine. I bring this up for this reason, not because I want you to send me sympathy cards or get well cards. I'm fine. I was never in any physical discomfort. The only thing that bothered me about that entire episode was when the nurse came in to wheel me to surgery and she said, okay, hugs and kisses time. No hug, no kiss from the nurse. Now, what's up with that? If it's hugs and kisses time, that means it's time for hugs and kisses. And I didn't get any. It's like, I seriously, I've taken this up with my insurance provider. I'm like, those guys cheated me. Anyway, if you have something on your person, on your forehead, on your arm, don't discount it. One of the most shocking things to me about this entire adventure, and I can call it that, was when my dermatologist told me that there are people who will let this thing go, something like this, for 2 years before they say, gee, maybe I ought to have it looked at. I waited 2 months, and I thought I waited too long. There is nothing painful about having it removed. There is nothing upsetting about going to see a dermatologist. Trust me, you wait 2 years, you're going to hear something a whole lot more upsetting than what I heard. So I urge you, please, to get it checked out. And just keep that between you and me, because I haven't told a lot of people about it. And I'm fine. Please don't worry. It was just very minor. I didn't even miss any games. And so I wanted to get that out of the way, just as a reminder to you. There are people who care about you. Don't ask me why. But if you value life, and I know you do, don't discount it. Don't ignore it. Go get it checked. The earlier the better. They say that about just about every type of cancer there is, and there's a reason they say it. It's because the earlier you find it, the easier it is to deal with it. I didn't have to go through radiation. I didn't have to go through chemo. I didn't have to do any of that stuff because I went in and got it detected very early. Okay, now to some lighter stuff. I saw a tweet last night. Eric Sorensen, you can get in on this if you like. If you like, of course you will. The NCAA guy tweeted out last night during the first four games, the first two opening round games.
Correct.
And I guess they were on True TV.
They were.
He tweeted out, the NCAA tournament, the only time of the year when anybody cares about True TV.
Unless you're a huge fan of the show Cops, you're correct.
Do they show Cops a lot?
Yeah, they show lots of reality, you know, my TV, son, cheaply produced.
My son tapes that show.
Garbage, but
DVDs that show
love.
Constantly because he wants to be a police officer.
I love Cops.
You know, it's interesting to me. This gets into another Uncle Jeff story time, and I don't think we have time to go into it. But those people at Fox, they're pretty smart. They took on a show like Cops. And if you go, really, if you think about it, if you're a network executive and a guy comes to you and says, we've got this show where a camera's going to follow police officers around and tape them arresting guys. And you kind of go, huh? Anyway, I'm one of those guys, and it's funny, NBC has made two gargantuan mistakes in its history. Maybe three if you include letting baseball get away at the end of 1989. In 1981, NBC televised their last NCAA tournament. And at the time, they would just show games on the weekends. They didn't show anything during the week. They might slip in a late night game on Thursday. That's pretty much in the regional finals in the Sweet 16. That was it. That's all you got from NBC. Because they thought nobody really nationally cares that much about college basketball. Whoops. The next year it went to CBS. And admittedly, CBS didn't show everything the first two rounds. They farmed it out to ESPN for about 5 or 6 years. But by the time it got to the Sweet 16, they're all over it. And they turned that tournament into the mega event it is today. CBS is directly responsible, maybe not wholly, but they have a large stake in turning that event into the mega event it is today. And NBC just goofed. They never should have let that tournament get away, and they did, and ain't never getting it back. The other mistake they made was in 1998 when Dick Ebersol decided he didn't want to pony up the money to keep the NFL. And how did that turn out? Now, they got it back, you know, 4 years later when they got the Sunday Night Football package. But they paid a ton more to get it, and they didn't get to keep all the AFC games on Sundays. They get one game a week, which, you know, it's a great game. But you think about it. People are taking days off tomorrow and Friday to watch the NCAA tournament. And 30 years ago, I realized the world is a lot different than it was 30 years ago. But, you know, if you're NBC, you know, even now, people at 30 Rock have got to be kicking themselves for letting that thing get out the door.
Did you happen to see the I Hate Christian Laettner 30 for 30 over
I
the
didn't,
weekend?
And I don't get what people hate Christian Laettner. I know about the shot, and I know he didn't have the greatest attitude in the world.
It's more, what I took away from it more than anything is that college basketball has really changed, and not for the better. I mean, they showed highlights, Jeff, from back when, you know, Laettner was in college and they played Michigan and those games against UNLV, and college basketball was so identifiable. Now it's just, I mean, someone came up to me this morning here at Skyview. They're going to Vegas, and they're like, okay, I need some teams to watch in the tournament. I'm just like, I can't help you. Come back during college football season. But right now, because college basketball in many ways is just sort of a puppy mill for the NBA with all these one-and-done players.
Yeah, I see what you're saying, and you're right. At the time when it was when Christian Laettner played, I was the PA announcer for the Suns, and he got drafted, I believe, by Minnesota.
Yep.
And when he arrived in the league, and he wasn't the megastar of college basketball, he was kind of, you know, on the next level down. But I remember the first time Christian Laettner came in with Minnesota, there was a huge buzz about him playing at the arena that night. You've lost that with college, with the way college basketball has changed. I mean, you think about it. The guy, if I had to pick out young player, first or second year player that's really made an impact immediately in the NBA, Anthony Davis.
Sure.
Certainly.
Yep.
But the list is very short. Now,
even Aaron Gordon, everyone thought like, oh, yep, he's ready. One and done off the NBA. And he's just been kind of
what's
there.
Anthony Wiggins done in Minnesota?
Not a little. I mean, he's shown a little promise, but once they get out of college, they just sort of blend in. And they're just most of these guys, like you said, they're just guys at the NBA.
Well, the other thing, and I'll say this in the NBA's defense, the one other thing about the draft that has changed is that you now have European players or foreign players that are mixing into the NBA draft, and you combine that with the one-and-dones. I've heard a lot of people say this year, boy, this is really a deep draft. It's going to be an interesting draft. It's been a while since the NBA draft as an event was really that compelling. If you own the number one pick, yeah, your fans are going to be tuned to the set to see who you draft. After that, it's kind of like, you know, you're pretty much down to the hardcore basketball fan, and it's not that big an event anymore. It was at one time in the 80s into the 90s. The NBA draft was a huge deal.
I mean, those Duke teams were literally like the traveling Beatles. Bobby Hurley, Christian Laettner, Brian Davis, Grant Hill, Coach K, Michigan with the Fab Five, UNLV with Anderson Hunt, Stacey Ogden, Larry Johnson.
Yep.
Now you just don't see that anymore. Like, there aren't the great storylines. I mean, March Madness is officially, I guess, starting tomorrow, even though they had the games. Yeah, exactly. They had the games last night. But it's just lacking something. Maybe I think that because Kentucky's undefeated, and by all accounts, unless they beat themselves, no one's going to beat them. But there's just a lull. There's just college basketball is just kind of stuck.
And a lot of people have talked about the Virginia effect and the fact that they are a very deliberate offensive team. As being a detriment to college basketball. Let me just say one thing about Virginia and their impact on college basketball. And for those who are not aware, I do play-by-play for Arizona State women's basketball, and we have NCAA tournament games of our own coming this weekend. I should have plugged that earlier. Saturday against Ohio University, 3:30 Wells Fargo Arena, and tickets are available, and they're really, really reasonably priced. I'll go into that next segment. A deliberate offense, first of all, it's within the rules, and it may be the one thing that keeps Kentucky from winning the tournament. I think Virginia could beat them if they can impose their tempo and their will on Kentucky, because a deliberate offense will frustrate a defense. They get frustrated when they have to play 30 seconds or in the men's game, 35 seconds of a possession, and it causes them to make silly mistakes. Just something to think about. More of the Brad Sesmatch Show upcoming. We'll hear from Brad in Portland on the NCAA tournament. Coming right up. Da, 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 da. Love this month. Jeff Munn for Brad Sesmatch. I'm with the Arizona Diamondbacks, Arizona State women's basketball. Yes, he will do a plug for his team here shortly. But right off the top, I'm going to get right out to Portland by way of Skype and visit with the guy who normally hosts this program, Brad Sesmatt, and his appearance and our coverage of the Arizona Wildcats' trek through March Madness is brought to you by Quarles and Brady LLP. They have offices across the country, including Phoenix, Scottsdale, and Tucson. Visit www.quarles.com. Brad joins us by way of Skype from there. He is in Portland, Oregon. You just got off the plane in the Portland airport, and I guess you have some company in red and blue up there already, right?
you know how this is, Jeff, through the years where if it's U of A in basketball or if it's Arizona State in football, it's like a traveling road show. And I think when it's U of A in basketball, it's like a wildcat convention up here. I'd say the airport was 90 to 95% red, white, and blue. I was in Oakland earlier. That was heavy U of A colors. And here in Portland, in about an hour, I'll head over to the Moda Center where the Cats will be doing their thing. And Texas Southern will be meeting with the media here in a little bit, too. But as to be expected, this is going to be a huge U of A weekend here, with most fans talking about how they're already looking ahead to next week in Los Angeles.
Brad Sesmat joins us via Skype from Portland International Airport. And you face a danger, obviously, when you don't take into account your opening round opponent. And especially in this case, because Texas Southern not only has some wins against quote-unquote Power 5 conference schools, they've got a very tournament-experienced head coach.
Well, there's no question about it, Jeff. I think if you look at the matchup just on paper, it'll be U of A favored a 2 against a 15. But eventually, there's going to be that 15 and that 16 that step up and knock somebody off. And Mike Davis, as you referred to, did a terrific job at Indiana, and then things went south on him. And they've played everybody and anybody. They won at Michigan State earlier this year. They've been all over the country, and so they're ready to go. And I think that when you look at just the players, the matchups, as you do doing your play-by-play prep, you look at the front line and you see it's 6'8", it's 6'6", it's 6'5" across the front line. In the meantime, U of A has Brandon Ashley and Caleb Tarzewski. They have a lot of size up front. So that would be one area of mismatch. And then the play of point guards, you know this as well as anybody. When you get to this time of year, TJ McConnell's been as good as anybody. You could have made the argument he could have been the Pac-12 player of the year. So I'm sure we'll hear a lot about that today, but I am intrigued to hear what Mike Davis has to say about his program. And, you know, Texas Southern is not a destination point for basketball players, and he won 22 games, and he won the SWAC this year. And I think it's a terrific storyline. And I know a lot of people are looking ahead to the potential of playing Ohio State in the next round or Virginia Commonwealth. But for me, and like you, I mean, where I think we're like-minded on this, the storylines are what makes this thing go this time of year.
Brad Sesmat joins us from Portland, and he's going to be there through the weekend, assuming that Arizona stays through the weekend, and I think the general consensus is they will. For Sean Miller, I've heard this said. He needs a Final Four run this year. I don't know if I'm comfortable with the word need, because this guy's not in any trouble. But if they didn't get to the Final Four in Indianapolis, is that a step back for Sean Miller in this program?
Well, I think you could certainly make that argument in some Wildcats fans' minds. I heard that up in Las Vegas last week at the Pac-12 tournament, Jeff, and then Greg Byrne was with us last Friday, and he alluded to how there's always going to be some that aren't happy that it's never quite good enough. There's no way that Sean's in trouble, but you also have to look at the bracket. They've got to go through Wisconsin again. The tournament did them no favors, putting Wisconsin over on this side. And in Los Angeles next week, that figures to be the major showdown, assuming everything breaks as planned. You know, you look at his point guard situation. If McConnell's not on this team, they're a different club, Jeff. And you can say that about a lot of squads. You take their point guard off the floor, and they're just not nearly as talented. But I think that the group that he has here has depth, has experience. Where they don't have experience is with their star freshman in Stanley Johnson. And sometimes he's a bull in a china shop, but he tries to do too much. Sometimes he's completely amazing. And other times he has the head coach and the assistant coaches slamming their clipboards and looking down at the ground, shaking their head in disgust. So when the bright lights go on tomorrow morning, this game times at 11:10, will Stanley Johnson step in it, so to speak, or will he embrace the moment? They'll say today, I'm sure, yeah, he's played a lot of big games in high school and played a lot of big games this year as a freshman. None bigger, though, than being in March Madness. And I think that's worth watching.
Brad Sesmat joins us from Portland. He'll be at the Moda Center later today and again tomorrow, and he'll join us tomorrow to kind of set the scene for Arizona's opening round game against Texas Southern. Let me take a step back and get a thought from you nationally, and I mentioned this a moment ago. A lot of people are talking about, well, Arizona is capable of beating Kentucky, maybe one or two other teams. I think Virginia is capable of doing it, too, for this reason. Their deliberate style, and I know it's been talked about a lot nationally the last couple of days, is whether or not it's good or bad for college basketball. But I've seen with my own eyes, through my own experiences this year, that a deliberate offense can frustrate a team when they're on defense, when they're defending that deliberate style. Because if you force them to play defense for 35 seconds, you raise the possibility of them committing silly fouls and just breaking down defensively. So if Virginia gets on the floor with Kentucky, and the only place they could do it would be in the national semifinals, I think if they impose their tempo on Kentucky, they could knock them off.
Well, I think that's it's a good argument to bring up about style of play. You know, is there a team, Jeff, that can be disciplined enough to keep the score in the 50s? You know, that's where I think it's got to be, 50s, maybe 60 at the top. But if you keep the score in a low-scoring, deliberate-style game and take the air out of the basketball, you know, that's a superstar team. That's a whole bunch of high school All-Americans that have bought in this year to their role in playing reduced minutes. We had Dan Marley on earlier this week, and he had the good fortune or lack thereof of playing Kentucky earlier this year straight up. And he's not sure anybody can take the air out of the basketball other than Wisconsin. And he did say U of A has a good shot against them too. But if you get that far in the tournament, I think the further that it goes for Kentucky, are they going to feel the pressure because those freshmen are so highly heralded? You know, the home court advantage, wherever Kentucky plays, they're going to have the crowd on their side for the most part until you get to Indianapolis. To me, it would be the stunner of stunners in sports over the last few years. This is like the UNLV running Rebels. Do you remember that squad?
Oh, yeah.
You know, Tark rolled out Larry Johnson and George Ackles and Greg Anthony and Anderson Hunt and all those players, Stacey Ogman. And this is similar to that feel that they are so deep and so talented, and nobody's expecting them to lose a game. But just like UNLV ended up losing, it could happen to Kentucky this year. It's just got to be the right style of play.
Be very interesting, to say the least. Brad, I know you're on your way to the Moda Center for the press conferences. Enjoy your time in Portland. We'll visit with you tomorrow and look forward to it.
And you do your good prep work for ASU women. Go Charlie. Get it done on Saturday, Jeff. Thanks for jumping in.
No problem. Glad to do it, and I will. And Brad Sesmat joining us from Portland on Skype. And we thank again Quarles & Brady LLP, Sports 360 AZ's exclusive partner for the Arizona Wildcats trek through March Madness. They have offices across the country, including Phoenix, Scottsdale, and Tucson. For more, visit www.quarles.com.